You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Past Prologue this week, beginning with Pac-Man Fever from Buckner and Garcia. And there is a clue, perhaps, in that musical number to our subject today. And we are joined by Andrew Elliott, Kat Fennelly and Tom Bishop, all of whom are here to talk about the subject of history and video games. So we might begin, I think, by asking why should historians or people who are interested in history take video games seriously? Who'd like to...
Well, I can certainly take up that gauntlet. There's two questions in there. I think one is, why should anyone take video games seriously? And we absolutely should. And, you know, the statistics are very, very clear on this. Yeah, even 10 years ago, for the very first time, video games outsold films or TV series very, very clearly. And that trend has continued and continued, particularly under the modern day, when with streaming services, actually the differences between playing games and traditional moving image-based media, those lines are becoming blurred more and more. So we should definitely take games seriously. They're doing something, some interesting cultural work. They're doing interesting things with their audiences and their players. And they are also an important medium in their own right. Whether historians should take video games seriously, I'm happy to leave as a question for the historians. I believe, as someone who works on history in the media, I believe that they do some interesting cultural work in terms of introducing new players to eras or periods or ideas or events that they may not otherwise know about. They also do interesting work in some ways as an archaeological medium in themselves, in some ways of challenging grand narratives, piecing together artifacts and so on, in order to make some kind of sense of the past, of who we are and how that informs, of who we were, sorry, and how that informs who we are. And I think to me that seems to be very similar to the historical process itself.
Tom, Kat, would you like to add to that?
I'll tackle one part of the question because, as Andy said, that's quite a big question. I mean, over the last 20 years in particular, historians really should probably take notice of games, just because it's a massive economic movement, but we're also seeing the rise of a new sport. I mean, esports is probably one of the fastest growing kind of phenomena on the planet. And it's also increasingly important to kind of a lot of countries' economies, specifically South Korea's. But I'll leave it to Tom to talk about why historians should take games specifically seriously.
Simple answer is yes, they should do. They should take video games seriously. I think what we're seeing within this question is this idea of a medium that, as Andy was saying before, has been kind of traditionally not taken as kind of seriously by academics as, say, film has been or music, but frequently it's the most common thing our students are engaging with as they come to kind of pick courses they're going to study at university. And within this, we need to think very carefully, both academically, with the sort of histories that they're engaging with, how these grand narratives are being explored, but also this kind of idea of playing history or living history. There's something, I think, about the interaction you get from video games that I think makes them so intellectually interesting for us to deal with. It's not just that you're watching things on a screen, you're not kind of this isolated person within a cinema engaging with these. You're playing it, you're experiencing, you're moving yourself through the past. And critically, in a lot of these games at the moment, you're making choices. And these choices mean that you have agency to shape historical events in lots of different ways. Within this, you kind of, what we could probably talk about examples of what we think are great video games within this, but specifically when it comes to kind of my lectures, whenever I give a lecture on the Cold War or nuclear culture in general, I'm amazed by how many students have played the Fallout franchise in some form or another. A game and a kind of franchise made by Bethesda before kind of Black Isle and stuff like that, that deliberately engages players with this aesthetic of creating kind of a 1950s suburban kind of experience that has kind of been sealed away in Fallout shelters, in vaults, for the player to reemerge and live through that. And within that, you're not just kind of living through this kind of Cold War propaganda in a nuclear landscape. You're listening to the music, you're talking to people. All of this stuff, I think, makes it so fascinating. I'm interested to hear what other people think about kind of as classic video games that they kind of think are great examples of kind of living history or playing history in some form or another.
Well, from my experience, when I teach 19th century cities, again, I've also found the amount of students that engage with kind of the 19th century city in the Assassin's Creed franchise, frankly, it's astonishing. And really, it allows kind of, I guess it allows us to give students an immersive experience in a way that they don't really get by just looking at a plan of a city, by going through walkthroughs of walking around kind of 19th century London, even if we're not actually engaging with the game, we're just using it as a walking simulator. It's a really useful tool for teaching students about the kind of the sensory environment as well. So they're not just seeing the city, they're also sort of hearing it. They're kind of experiencing the menace of walking between the shadows of gas lamps, that kind of thing. And it's an experience that you can kind of only get from an immersive environment like a game. You don't really get the same sense from a film. That's my experience with kind of using games and teaching anyway.
Andy, did you want to add anything?
Well, I would only add as an interesting example. I mean, those immersive games are really fascinating games, and I've done some work on the Assassin's Creed series as really interesting ways of engaging with what we can see is a weird simulacrum of Florence, you know, where it's sort of Florence then, which you can experience now. And if you've ever played Assassin's Creed series and played through Assassin's Creed 2 in Florence and then been to Florence, it's a very strange experience where you're simultaneously living in the past and the present. The other big sort of genre I would pick out would be grand strategy games, in terms of teaching the kind of the contingency of history and the teleology of history, those kind of this happened and therefore the other thing happened, which also allows for things like counterfactual histories, which, you know, were once disparaged by E.H. Carr as a parlor game, but are actually a really interesting way of thinking about the past.
Do you think there's an issue of isolation with playing these games, that it's that they're sort of immersed in their own particular world, and they get, you know, because the choice element that you were talking about, that they're very much able to construct it along their own sort of individual lines, as opposed to sort of other more communal forms of experiencing the past, where you're perhaps challenged to debate it more than you might be in this scenario?
Not necessarily. I mean, a lot of the, I guess, academic engagements that I've read with games are actually in things like Second Life, which are open world, in which people engage with each other within a virtual world, so that actually you're meeting strangers in in the virtual world itself, and you're engaging with that kind of environment. Second Life was, still is, kind of a really valuable tool for kind of teaching about places like Châtelhayoc, for instance, which have their own kind of simulacrum in within the game itself. It's the same goes for kind of massive multiplayer online games. It just allows for kind of quite a lot of social engagement in a way that maybe doesn't follow traditional lines of engagement in terms of kind of conversation, but it is definitely social.
Yes, I would actually add on that. There is that sort of playing on there is a great misconception about video games that we have misconceptions about the games and about the players. You know, very often the first image that will come to mind will be the sort of the teenage boy in their parents' basement playing games and obsessed with those games, which simply isn't the case. I mean, in terms of the gender split, we know that that's nothing like it. In terms of the demographic, if you see the costs of video games, you understand why it's 25 to 35-year-olds who are buying most of these games. Also, in terms of what we define as a game, Jesper Juhl's done some really interesting work, and he has a book called Casual Games, where he sort of sees almost everything as a game. And in fact, the Charlie Brooker 100 Video Games That Changed the World, the number one was Twitter, which he sees as a video game when you're trying to permanently level up and play. And that introduces that element of games which are fundamentally social. And, you know, Kat was talking about the massive multiplayer online games and so on. There are games that are massively social. There are huge numbers of people there. So it's not this question of isolation and immersion within a specific world where you are on your own. You're permanently interacting, playing puzzles, as Tom says, and interacting with the game environment. So I would say there is a fundamentally social element to them anyway.
I was younger, I was into video games, trying to whatever, it didn't matter the name. Thousands of my dollars have been poured into all types of games, trying to get the high score. But now I think I have a favorite, it's me against the Nate, he's got my girl, I've got to save her. Oh no, I feel an attack coming on. Yo, ready Roxy, I wanna play a game with Donkey Kong. I have. I would feel the urge and I go stuck raving mad, breaking to the arcade, screaming and hollering, anticipating putting $25 in any machine. I was out of control. I didn't need quarters. I brought $10 bankrolls, bags of quarters. I was insane. People thought that I worked there and asked me for change, but I would get defensive and yell, "Leave me alone! These are my quarters, stupid. Go get your own." Dude walked away with this look in his eyes like, "Oh man, I wonder what's wrong with that guy." I was addicted, a video burnout, and I would go crazy when the guy would have to turn out the lights at midnight. I'd fall on my knees and say, "Have a hard time, one more game, please." Some nights I might sleep on the subway or outside of the arcade till it opened up the next day. And when it opened at 9:45, it was the same old thing all over again. I was doing bad, my future was bleak. I'd rather play games than eat or sleep. Until one day, this guy came along. He didn't have a radio, but he was playing a song. I got curious, so I said, "Yo, what's that noise?"
"What noise? I don't know."
"No, fool, that noise you was making there."
"What, this?"
"Yeah, that was death, man. Where'd you learn to do that?"
"Man, I don't know. I guess I always knew that. I had this talent deep down inside. Hush, you wanna hear some more, man?"
"Yeah.
Come on, let's take a ride."
He made sounds like I never heard before, and he still had more. Then he got me hyped when he played this incredible song, and I lost my mind when Ready C played Donkey Kong. Feel great, and I haven't been in an arcade since '78. Thanks to
already see I'm on an upward trail because he's always by my side. He never fails me. Whenever I have a video attack, he's right there.
Human
by
Video
my
Game. By DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, who I've just been insultingly asked whether I know who they are. Actually, it's fair enough. My expertise is more classical. But moving back to this question of video games, I just wanted to pick up on something that we were talking about in the last segment, which was this idea about the uses of archaeology in video games and these very detailed sort of reconstructions of cities that a couple of you were talking about. And I was wondering how much we know about how they're building these pictures up, what sort of research they're using, these kind of things.
Okay. Well, I mean, especially for kind of big budget AAA games, especially ones that have come out recently, most notably the last two Assassin's Creed games, there's been a lot of coverage about the research that goes into the particular game development process. Archaeologists have been consulted. They do consult experts. They consult quite a lot of published material in order to make the game environment as realistic as possible. The Assassin's Creed franchise has kind of gone above and beyond with this by creating gameplay options in which you can just walk around and use it as a pedagogical tool rather than having to engage in combat while you're doing it. And this makes it quite valuable as an educational tool for teaching things like the ancient world. So the last two games, I think I've looked at Ptolemaic Egypt and Greece, and there is quite a lot of research that goes into those. These are not media that are being produced without consultation with experts. There is quite a lot of work that goes into it. The most notable example that I've come across recently as well is the Town of Light. It came out in 2016. It's a small game. It's entirely kind of set in a lunatic asylum in Italy. And in order to produce the game environment, the asylum was photographed extensively. But also quite a lot of archival research was undertaken so that a lot of the engagements within the game with things like documents and maps and plans, these are all actual archival materials that you can go and visit in Volterra in Italy. And this, I think, goes to show the level of care and responsibility that developers take when they approach historical video games.
I feel we're not far away from the impact case study of the academic who has changed the video game world through this kind of research. So we've talked a bit about how history is being used in some of these video games and why we should be concerned about it as historians, and a couple of you mentioned how you've dealt with this in teaching. I wondered, have you also been working on this from sort of a more research point of view?
I think almost as an inevitability, I think most of us are now turning to look at video games when it comes to research. I think to ignore them at the moment, considering kind of the landscape, seems to be missing out a huge source base that we can kind of look at and engage with in some form. When it comes to my stuff, because I write extensively about nuclear culture and nuclear society when it comes to America, there's lots of kind of different material that we can kind of engage with in some form or another. I've mentioned the Fallout games before, but within this, what I've been starting to do is think critically about how I could actually start to map this onto current public perceptions of what the apocalypse is, or basically how nuclear narratives have changed over the course of from the 1940s up until now. We've got lots of brilliant work from people like Robert Jacobs or Paul Boyer, which talk about the newness of the nuclear moment and this almost idea of the neutering of it, the idea that we become we accommodate the bomb in some form or another. What we're seeing really interestingly when it comes to the Fallout series is this idea of we're not just accommodating the bomb, we're creating these kind of survivalist fantasies that are becoming some of the biggest selling franchises we can imagine. It's very kind of strange for me when the last Fallout 4 game came out, which is a few years ago now, to see images of nuclear bombs and Fallout shelters on the side of buses as a thing of that we can consume or purchase or buy or experience in some form or another. I think especially when we think about the different waves of nuclear culture and nuclear identity, the 60s, we've got the 80s with the protests and the freeze movements. I think we are entering a new age now in which the nuclear has become this kind of consumer product that you can kind of buy and have it kind of printed onto a Coke bottle without any sense of irony to that at all. So I think this is me kind of struggling with what I want to do with it, but it has to be written, I think, in some form or another.
Are you able to say something just for the benefit of any listeners who haven't played the game, how it, I mean, what the sort of end point is that you're supposed to be trying to reach in it?
Sure. So the one of the things about the Fallout games is that they are, by the definition, what we call massive RPGs. So the big open world games. The games start with the new one, Fallout 4. It starts before the bomb hits, and you're in this kind of suburban home. And suddenly there's going to be a nuclear attack. You're one of the few people got access to the vault. So you go down. You're sealed away. You wake up from being frozen to kind of enter into this new landscape. Ironically, it also ends with you trying to blow up one of the factions in some form or another and kind of dropping a weapon of your own. But then after that, the idea is it's just a playground for you to explore. You can kind of build settlements, you can interact with people. It's designed for you to kind of immerse not just kind of a 30-hour experience, but a 200-hour, a 300-hour experience. It's a game that you kind of can play for a year if you want to. And just kind of experience or walk or live in this world. I think that's what the end point really is, to kind of get to a point where you get bored of living through an apocalypse and surviving it in some form or another.
Do you think there are any worrying consequences from... Because I was very interested in what you were saying about this phenomenon of the nuclear is something we can consume now and that we can, you know, put on the side of a Coke bottle without anybody batting an eyelid or worrying about it. And I wonder, does that mean that we've... that there's at least a segment of society that's reached a stage of sort of a sort of blasé attitude to something that potentially enormous ramifications.
Where I think we find this really interestingly is within first-person shooter games and the Call of Duty franchises. Mm. There was this moment a few years ago when we had some quite sensitive depictions of soldiers when it comes to Spec Up the Line, which is a really interesting game where it deals very sensitively with this idea of trauma and war, and now we've got returning to this stage where we're refighting the Nazis, often in space in some form or another, or we're just kind of experiencing this glorification of some sort of kind of new Cold War killing experience constantly. I think that's the ones I'm more concerned with, because their whole ethos, to an extent, is this idea of selling the sensation of war in some form. And I think that's one of the more problematic things with it. With Fallout, there's a little bit of sensitivity to some of the stuff, to an extent, but with the Call of Duty shooting games, it's a bit more in your face, bombastic.
And actually, I mean, it is very tempting to see this kind of alarmist rhetoric surrounding the games, and particularly something like America's Army, which is, you know, used as a recruiting tool. However, at the same time, I do think, perhaps in my eternal naive optimism, I do think that games can provide sometimes the solution to those. So, I mean, there's a game called Valiant Hearts about the First World War, which is immensely sensitive and immensely moving. And it's not the kind of the first-person shooter you would quite imagine. It's something that actually integrates you into the emotional lives of the participants of war, not necessarily purely from a soldier's perspective. So I think sometimes that same aspect which can make for a kind of a consumerist or a kind of a shallow engagement with the past can also make for a really, really engaging and a multifaceted approach.
I think this is the thing. Just like with any kind of good film or good book, there's good or bad examples. I'm thinking just of Papers, Please as an absolutely fantastic example. Papers, Please is a game where you basically play someone who is in passport control, and your job is to approve or deny visas, and that's what you do for the game. And you're playing in a fictional Eastern European state, and as the game progresses, the requirements for letting new people in become more complicated. And you need to kind of process enough visas through the day to have enough money for your family. And it's a game that basically ends with you being unable to kind of keep up with the job as it goes through. But it's an absolutely beautiful portrayal of the escalation of kind of state control within an Eastern European state and the kind of human drama behind migration. In very simple, you say yes or no to a visa that goes through. But within that kind of simple action of pressing that button and literally putting the stamp down, we're seeing something much more complicated and ultimately human emerging from that.
That's not to say, of course, that they're all good. There is a game called JFK Reloaded, if you've ever played it, where it is basically what it sounds like, the assassination, and you are the assassin. And it's horrific. It's horrific as a game.
Games can also provide a forum for kind of opening interesting conversations about kind of uncomfortable topics. Mm. So one of the things that brought me to doing things like... lunatic asylum architecture research in the first place was I was concerned about the problematic representation of the architecture and material culture of lunatic asylums, of mental hospitals, of mental illness in general, in games and in film, back in the mid-2000s. And at the time, kind of, I guess mental illness was used as a shorthand for chaos and horror. And this has kind of quite a long lineage going back to kind of well, in film much longer, but with games going back to kind of the early 80s with games like Asylum. And then, I mean, the scariest video game level of all time, Robbing the Cradle from Thief Deadly Shadows, is set in a lunatic asylum. So I started to become concerned with kind of how asylums were represented and how this didn't actually match up to the reality of what I was doing. And I'm really, really glad to see that in the last kind of 2 years, there's been a lot of interesting conversations about the kind of, I guess, use and abuse of mental illness in video games as kind of a lazy shorthand, effectively, for chaos and horror. And that's starting to turn now because of those conversations and those problematic representations.
Fell in love at the Video Arcade by Arcade and the Video Victims. It's an absolute mouthful, some of these titles this week. I have to say, I'm learning an awful lot about all this because I may know some of these who some of these performers are, but I know very little about video games, so it's an education for me. Kat, you were saying while the music was playing, you'd like to talk a bit about the concept of the retro game?
Yeah, so we've been talking an awful lot about kind of, well, 3D games specifically. But I mean, video games have a much longer history than that. And there's some really interesting research being done at the moment in kind of archaeology, media, history about retro games and kind of games of the past. And what's interesting, I guess, about kind of old games, games for kind of the Amiga or what have you, is that you have entire subcultures of people in the 80s and the 90s whose primary material culture is basically virtual, and that their engagement with kind of I guess a virtual world means that they don't have a material culture of the world that they engaged in most often, and that all that is left is kind of consoles and cartridges, and there's obviously a big market for collecting these things, but also these things have quite a big footprint as well, and they're interesting as kind of tech in themselves, given our society and how it's moving forward. It's kind of interesting to look at kind of the development, or I guess the typological development of games, from being kind of effectively giant clumps of plastic to now being something that you download straight to a computer or your phone, that doesn't actually require that level of kind of material engagement. So that's kind of, I guess I just wanted to mention it because there's quite a lot of really good, interesting research going on there.
I'm wondering if there's also an interesting environmental discussion around some of that stuff, because, of course, obviously, as you were saying, that there's a big sort of footprint in terms of the plastic and the size of mm-hmm. some of those original consoles. But I suppose now the effect would be that with the kind of virtual world, there's a big power drain, in the same as there's all this discussion about the power effects of the cloud.
Yeah, I mean, There is an environmental discussion to be had about kind of what we do with the amount of retro tech that we have. In terms of what we have now, and well, in the fact that we don't actually have kind of a material culture of gaming to the same extent, we really do now have to start developing strategies for looking at kind of, I guess, what will be the archaeology of now, for looking at how we would look at the virtual in the future. Because currently on the ground, this is the time to think about how we actually preserve our own present, so that in the future we have a past to look back on as we become increasingly more virtual.
Are there issues with accessing already the retro sort of archive that you were talking about, that already we can't necessarily load things up in the same way or keep the systems working?
Yeah, there kind of is. I mean, you can download things like emulators and use them, but you don't get the same experience of gameplay. I mean, using something like a kind of a ZX Spectrum in the 1980s is very different to just downloading a game straight to your computer and playing it there and then. I mean, the keyboard's different for one thing. The engagement with the screen is different as well. So it's important to kind of preserve the experience of using this material, but also engaging with that environment in the medium in which it was intended to be produced, while we still can.
And of course, the question of arcades and the physical space of the arcade and the two-player game in the arcade, which was also, at the risk of harping on about the social aspect, was also a social angle to it, that the place that you would go to before the advent of home computing and the sort of so-called fifth-generation consoles. This space of a two-player game where you would actually have the physical cabinet that I think are becoming collector's items again. People are now building their own with emulators inside. But there is, yes, a fundamentally different form of engagement with playing Mortal Kombat in the 1990s on a two-player arcade than there is in playing in an emulator on your own.
And with that, we're also seeing the rise of kind of Twitch TV and people actually watching people play video games. I mean, the viewing figures for both YouTube Live and Twitch, which is this kind of online platform, we can actually sit there and watch someone play Fortnite, for example, and comment on it, are huge. And the money behind it, as Kat was saying before, when it comes to esports, is becoming a verifiable thing in its own right. Bit slow in the UK to take on, but in places like South Korea and America as well, these esport events where you would go and watch two teams play a variety of games are becoming huge kind of money makers for a lot of these people. And it is a new way that we're engaging, shifting away from traditional forms of viewing or playing to watching people play, which is a phenomenon in and of its own right, I think.
Is there a gender issue with...
Crying anxious tear.
computer games from MySex or VSex. We weren't quite sure what how the pronunciation was. We were talking just at the end there about the coming back to this question of the gaming kind of industry and the video games as a sport. And I was wanted to pose the question of whether there's a issue about gender in relation to the sport, whether there are equal opportunities, what the sort of audience makeup is like.
I will answer this. In the short answer, yes. But I think that's the same with any kind of sporting industry or major kind of like emerging consumer product or commercial phenomenon. I think I'm going to start with a positive note. What I've always thought is so amazing about gaming cultures and gaming communities is that, especially in recent years, we've seen them become incredibly diverse, incredibly more sensitive. Games such as Gone Home, or even the communities that are going to emerge around games such as Mass Effect, show a really fascinating, vibrant and important diversification when it comes to video games, especially in their depiction. However, there has been a lot of kind of reports, especially around the esports community, of certain kind of toxic masculine behaviours that have become quite prominent. There's stuff within the Overwatch League as well, which means that there is this kind of problem. And also there's this kind of conception, especially around popular YouTubers, I think the controversy that surrounds people like PewDiePie, I think is the main one, about becoming symbols of the far right in some form or another. Even when it comes to bringing a really kind of down topic, when it came to the shootings in New Zealand, this idea of the shooter saying that I'm being live streamed, I'm doing this for the views before they went in, shows how toxic and dangerous this is. Whether this is because video games are the new thing, or have been the new thing since the 1980s, I think, but whether they are becoming this kind of cultural zeitgeist that we're all kind of fixating on, or whether this is just another wave of people who thought that when Doom came out in the early 90s, this is going to lead to a sparking of kind of school shootings and stuff like that. Whether we think this is all part of the same cultural zeitgeist is a question that kind of academics can talk about. But I think the most important thing to remember is that just as there are good and bad sides of society, there's good and bad sides of gaming communities.
Is that producing, is there any sort of pressure for regulation coming in as a result of these sort of worries about, you know, I mean, for example, the shooting in New Zealand, things like that?
I mean, it's quite interesting, exactly as Tom was saying, that we like to tie these two things together and then prompt legislation. So it reminds me of the video nasties debate in the 1990s when we have Michael Howard, you know, prompting the Newsom report. The problem with those, let me say something reasonably controversial, is that the authors of the Newsom report have no idea how media work. They were psychologists and they were historians. And you and I know, in fact, one of the authors of the report, and I think he himself would acknowledge that they are problematic. And so the same sort of knee-jerk reaction to legislation for one specific medium is problematic. I mean, James Curran and Gene Seaton have that wonderful line about the internet, that they say the internet is no more equal or unequal than society. They simply mirror the offline inequalities online. And so the same thing, I think, is happening with games, that any kind of knee-jerk reaction to that, which would lead to legislation, would be deeply problematic, because it would be based on assumptions about media and media effects, which are not really tenable. I mean, the other classic example when we're talking about shootings is Anders Behring Breivik in Oslo, who trained for his shooting, according to his self-titled manifesto, trained playing Call of Duty. That doesn't mean that you should instinctively ban Call of Duty. This is, to go into the media effect stuff, this is a psychodynamic problem rather than a specific media-related problem. So I'd be sceptical of legislation. I'm glad to see that there hasn't been that sort of media furore, that kind of media hype reacting to that.
I wanted to ask one other question about this gaming the kind of sports gaming culture, which is what kinds of games have become the main ones that are appearing in that forum. I was wondering, is it more the sort of massive kind of role-playing ones or more of the kind of strategy ones?
I mean, it started, I guess, if you're going to put a genesis on this, it started with StarCraft in the 1990s. And StarCraft was massive in South Korea. And it became kind of, I guess, a massive public event to go and watch people play StarCraft, sometimes in costume, for instance. So StarCraft II, which came out this decade, things like League of Legends, Dota, these are strategy games that you can play kind of with lots of people. So these are the games that tend to kind of top the charts. But increasingly, games like Overwatch, which is a cooperative multiplayer online game in which you play, I think, a six-person team or a several-person team, and you take on another team within the game. These are becoming increasingly more popular to watch as well.
And within this, you kind of have, these teams have their own kits, they have their own personalities, and they have their own styles that you are following within it. So it is mirroring kind of real life sport as closely as they can get, including the sponsorships and the promotions around it as well.
So you've got a kind of fan culture as well.
Exactly, yeah, huge fan culture, yeah, massive.
I mean, lots and lots of people go to places like Las Vegas and Seoul to watch other, to watch these teams play. And I mean, the Overwatch League is franchise like the NFL now. I mean, you can buy a team. Well, if you're a billionaire, you can buy a team and house them and train them and they play for you. So.
And these do prompt new kind of engagements with history in terms of going back to the past. So these kind of online games like World of Warcraft is a classic example, which is, I mean, I see it, perhaps rightly or wrongly, I see it as a continuation of exactly the same instinct as Dungeons & Dragons did in the 1970s, 80s and 90s. And that prompts, what we're seeing increasingly is that prompts an interest in the past. Very wrongly in the case of World of Warcraft, but the number of students who want to talk to me about medievalism in the Elder Scrolls and the Skyrim series or something, you know, are fascinating in that they're prompting these really interesting questions of, well, okay, I get that there weren't dragons, but what about this kind of warfare? Was this more common? Or what about this kind of landscape and so on? And so I'm seeing that as another really interesting area where people are playing these games and bringing up new questions about the past, which sometimes we haven't thought to ask, I don't think.
To make a rather embarrassing kind of confession, basically everything I know about tank warfare comes from Hidden and Dangerous. I'm playing Hidden and Dangerous in 1999. I learned how to do tank warfare in the Second World War. As a result, I wrote lots of essays in history and was very good at history about this. So, I mean, it really did prompt and kind of encourage my interest in history to play historical video games.
So where? Sorry, I was going to have to ask what Hidden and Dangerous is doing.
Hidden and Dangerous is it's a game from the late 90s where you control a squad of SAS soldiers towards the close of the Second World War, and you go from various kind of parts. You go to Italy, you go to Czechoslovakia, you go to Norway, and you have to conduct covert missions. And one of the things that you have to do is take down a Tiger tank. And I know from playing Hidden and Dangerous that you have to attack a Tiger tank from the back. So. I also know quite a lot of other things about Hidden and Dangerous.
If World War III ever erupts. So Tom has been dying to talk about a game, Red Dead Redemption, for about the last 20 minutes.
I have been.
So I'm going to give you your opportunity.
Thank you, Finn. I get my soapbox now. Now I've been on the edge of my seat. I think it really returned to this question of good practice when it comes to video games, and especially stuff that students have been engaging with. So Red Dead Redemption 2 came out last year, and in essence, it's a grand tale of the kind of decline of the American West and the decline of a certain form of lifestyle within it. When I was teaching the course that me and Finn run on the presidency last year, and we were kind of doing the lectures on Theodore Roosevelt and his time as a Rough Rider and his time kind of going to the frontier, the students were playing the game simultaneously, and I was, what I found so remarkable was how effective the game was proving as a kind of text for them to engage with. And when I was playing it through myself, what I was so struck by was not only the kind of ideas that the game itself is reconstructed from all these really beautiful Thomas Moran paintings of the American, you know, the America sublime. You literally sit and you play the game and you're looking at a landscape painting in some form or another. But it's when I came to a certain chapter and it was called The New South. I said, like, well, I'm reading a C. Van Woodward text at this point. And the way and the sensitivity in which they deal with this kind of Reconstruction America was really remarkable. And I think one of the things that I was kind of so struck by with it is just how effective that game was, both for students, but also as a thing that deserves serious consideration as historians thinking about how we're representing or re-representing or challenging the myths of the frontier in some form or another. And I was just wondering if anyone else could think of any kind of excellent games that they're thinking are really good for students to use in some form or another.
Well, I already mentioned The Town of Lights. I mean, I think anyone who's going to look at video games should really play that, because it's almost kind of less of a game and more of a visual novel, in that you walk around a lot, you interact with activities. There's no real kind of, I guess, peril, but it's terrifying. It's really scary. And I walk through a lot of abandoned asylums, and I've never been as uncomfortable as I've been in that game. But I think it gives a really, really beautiful sense of space, and a really, really good representation of kind of just how uncomfortable a building like that can make you feel if you don't know what you're looking at, which I think is an experience that I can't have because I do know what I'm looking at, but somebody who's not engaged with kind of those spaces may not. So I think it's definitely worth playing and having a go at.
I haven't yet thought of any ways to introduce any games into my teaching, but no, this has given me a lot to think about.
Presumably one of the challenges with it is that you wouldn't, having the technology to show the game in the classroom or enable students to play it simultaneously in the classroom. I imagine we haven't got quite to that point yet.
I think some of the other issues is that it can never be a substitution for reading or kind of engaging with right. actual historical material. They can be very good simulations of the past, but to truly understand the past in any way, you need the students to be reading the books, engaging with that. And I think sometimes it can become students a bit of a shorthand. I've played a video game, or I've watched Deadwood on TV. I know everything there is about the West now.
Right.
And because of that, what you're dealing with like any of these texts, is a very curated experience designed for entertainment in some form or another. And because of that, there is this always a danger. But as a teaching tool, I think there's so much potential about trying to get students to engage with the past through interaction in some form or another.
I mean, part of that is in the definition of games itself, right? I mean, so, you know, anthropologists and historians for years have been trying to define what games are, and Johann Huizinga is the famous kind of book Homo Ludens talking about it. But the eventual definition that Roger Kaiwa talks about includes the voluntary overcoming of unnecessary obstacles. And as soon as you introduce it into teaching, you lose that sense of voluntary, which is potentially quite difficult. Once it becomes work, it's perhaps a different kind of approach to the game.
So. I've had really good examples of people in primary school using it with children to develop their creative writing skills or their kind of journalism skills as well, because they're supposed to play a game such as Minecraft, which is this game where you just build stuff, you kind of harvest resources, very simple. Getting the kids to play that for about 30 minutes, stopping it and say, write down what you did for that 30 minutes, and it focuses them, and apparently they're actually engaging quite creatively with describing, using kind of new language and stuff like that, using games as that kind of starting point for them to think critically about kind of developing writing skills for the first time.
Yeah. There are plenty of examples, yeah. Harry Brown and James Bulgee both talk extensively about video games and education.
I was going to ask if there was any period in history that hasn't been featured in a game that you think ought to be, but I've been getting the signal that we're running rapidly towards the end of our time. So I think we'll have to leave it there. In what's been a really particularly educational for me, as I was saying earlier on, as someone who really doesn't play video games. So I'd like to thank the three panellists, Andrew Elliott, Kat Fennelly, Tom Bishop, and Alex Efchuk, who as usual has been keeping us on the air and sorting out the music and all the technical gubbins that enable this show to happen. And thank you for listening, and we hope to be back with you in about a month's time.